In most cases, we're going to be providing no-cost solar to both owners and tenants. There may be some financial contribution for the affordable housing developer for the common meter, but we're really trying to maximize savings to families because we know that across the country, people struggle to pay their utility bills.
Welcome to Buzz House, a Baker Tilly podcast where you can hear all the buzz around multifamily housing with all the info you need to help you win now and anticipate tomorrow. Hi, I'm Don Bernards, the principal in charge of Baker Tilly's multifamily housing practice.
And I'm Garrick Gibson, a principal at Baker Tilly, also specializing in consulting on multifamily housing transactions across the country.
Let's get started. Since the Inflation Reduction Act was passed in August of 2022, so a little over 2 years now, that time kind of flew, Garrick and I have had numerous discussions around provisions of this act, starting with increases in credits for solar in your affordable multifamily housing project, which will be typically maybe 30 to 50% credit, a range of qualifying costs, 30, 50%. Fast forward here to 2024 and sticking with solar, $7 billion, with a B, $7 billion was awarded to 60 recipients across the country under the Solar for All program, which falls within the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. There's also NCIF and CCIA, but today we're specifically talking about Solar for All program. We're very excited to have today as a guest, Erica Mackey, the Grid Alternatives CEO and co-founder. Grid Alternatives was selected for two grants under the Solar for All program, including almost $250 million to serve Americans living in rented and owned affordable housing across the nation, along with a little over $62 million to partner with tribal nations with a focus on a handful of states. We'll cover a lot more about the goals of Solar for All, diving into Grid's programs and so forth. Again, very excited to have you, Erica. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Garrick to kick things off. Garrick?
Thank you, Don, and glad to have you on, Erica. And glad to have you joining the Buzz House podcast for a topic that we definitely want to hear about. But before we get into questions, would you please let our listeners know a little bit more about your professional background and the role of Grid in community-led renewable energy solutions?
Sure. Thanks for having me. So a little bit about me. I'm what I often say is a mechanical engineer or a social worker turned mechanical engineer turned back something in between. So out of high school, went to college and studied women's studies, did a lot of work in sort of the social sector, then got a degree in mechanical engineering. And Tim Sears and I hatched the idea of Grid Alternatives about 20 years ago. And fast forward to today, Grid Alternatives is a nonprofit organization. We really consider ourselves a social justice organization that uses renewable energy as our tool for social justice. And if you think about a climate justice ecosystem, we're primarily builders and innovators. So about half of our staff are actually construction and outreach staff. So we, you know, roll trucks, we install solars and EV chargers, all for families that otherwise wouldn't be able to get it without our program, and in communities that are really on the front lines of environmental justice, economic justice, and really leading the way in terms of a clean energy transition. We, in terms of regional scope, we have an office in a bunch of offices in California, an office in Denver, Colorado, one in Washington, D.C. We have a very substantial tribal program, which is indigenous led and run, that serves about 70 plus sovereign nations contained within the borders of the United States. And we have a small but mighty international program that works in Nepal, Nicaragua, and northern Mexico. And then also we do a bunch of workforce development. So all of our work is install it, make it happen, lower people's bills, but also train people to get jobs in the clean energy industry from those same communities. So everything we do has a workforce development component, and we have what we mostly call installation basic training, where we have classroom, lab, wraparound services, so job readiness, and then actual paid on-the-job training on real installs to get that experience to join the clean energy industry.
Well, thanks. Thanks for that background information. So we're going to go ahead and dive into our first questions, Erica. Would you please let our listeners know what the overall premise for the Solar for All program is? I know it's been floating around and everybody wants to know, and I'm sure you have a lot of insight here.
Yeah. So the Solar for All program, like you said, is a $7 billion program as part of the Inflation Reduction Act. And it went out to about 60 total awardees that included ourselves and the grants that we're going to talk about. But it also went to states, to coalitions, to tribes, to really bring solar into communities and communities that really need the benefits and often have the least access to solar. So it's to lower people's bills, lower hardworking families' bills, and make renewable energy a solution that can lift up all of our communities. And that's really the basis of the program. But every state and every tribal coalition and every tribe and every nonprofit had a little bit of a different, unique twist to what they plan to do with those dollars in their communities.
Erica, thank you again for that on the macro level. And then kind of jumping into your two awards, again, maybe staying at a relatively high level, because I know there's a lot of details we'll get into in a few questions. Yeah, tell us just a little bit about, right, kind of the two awards. Congratulations on that, first of all. Almost $250 million for, I think, more of a nationwide affordable housing, and then along with the $62 million tribal program. So maybe just, again, maybe a 1,000-foot global level of those kind of two awards, what they're looking to accomplish.
Sure. So as you mentioned, we have two awards that we got. One is basically expanding our tribal work, and one is expanding our work with affordable housing developers. So the first one is what we're calling SANA, or Solar Access for Nationwide Affordable Housing, and GRID led a coalition of nonprofit organizations to say, okay, we have a huge affordable housing footprint in this country. How can we solarize that footprint and really work to lower renters' and homeowners' bills in the process? So some of the key partners include Habitat for Humanity, NeighborWorks, Enterprise, LISC, and a wide variety of other nonprofit partners. And we will work in almost 30 states and territories to help solarize their footprint. And while right now we're still working with EPA to finalize our work plan, we don't know how many installations we're going to do in each state specifically. We want to use an inclusive process to get to that, but it is certain that we're going to serve around 37,000 households across these 30 states. And we're going to build on the last 20 years of what we've been doing. A lot of those partners are partners that we've been working for 10, 15, even 20 years. And we're going to say, okay, we know how it works to work with Habitat in Denver. We can then expand that to work with Habitat affiliates throughout the country. So it has a single family and a multifamily and a little bit of a community solar component. And in that way, we can serve Americans that really need the power, whether or not they be a homeowner that got their home through a special program with one of these affordable housing developers, or they live in affordable housing as a renter. And then the other program is what we're calling Western Indigenous Network, or WIN Solar for All. It is a coalition of tribes to work on tribal lands in Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, and Utah. So five states, generally in sort of an expansive view of the Southwest. And it will do some re-gifting of dollars, so granting to tribes to do solar projects, energy projects in the way that they see fit, and also helping with some implementation and technical assistance. So really moving towards energy sovereignty, self-determination that tribes are owed, and doing that in a renewable energy context.
Thank you, Erica, for that overview. Kind of a next question is a follow-up. You mentioned both single family and multifamily. We've heard lots of questions on multifamily. How do you get and prove that benefit to the individual tenants?
Yeah. One thing that's great is that we have successfully helped administer California's SOMA program, which is a solar for multifamily affordable housing program, over the last many years. And that program specifically names tenant benefits as an important part of the program. So in the states that we hope to work in for Solar for All, we hope to use some virtual net energy metering. So if folks don't know what that is, it means that your bill can go down even though the solar may not be attached to your meter. And that is, you know, in a maybe two handfuls of states across the country. So there's virtual net metering in those states. And then many more states have sort of permissive market conditions, community solar laws, virtual net metering, or other laws on the books or coming that could help with tenant benefits. And then in states where we need a policy fix to be able to provide those benefits to tenants, we're also looking into things like community benefit agreements, which can then say, all right, well, the affordable housing development got solar, and the way to pass along those benefits to tenants is to do more programming in the community. Or interesting things that we've been thinking about are like, well, could you then put, you know, EV chargers in the parking lot so you don't have that? Well, where would I charge if I got an electric vehicle? So just thinking about the myriad of services that affordable housing provides and how can you get the savings? If you can't get it directly to the tenant bill, then how can you get those savings into community benefits for those tenants? So, you know, we're still working out with EPA exactly what that's going to look like. But EPA has put as a floor, you must provide 20% savings to families. And so we're going to do that. In most cases, we're going to be providing no cost solar to both owners and tenants. There may be some financial contribution for the affordable housing developer for the common meter, but we're really trying to maximize savings to families because we know that across the country, people struggle to pay their utility bills.
Very good, Erica. That was very helpful. And I learned a lot from that response. Maybe one more question before I turn over to Garrick. And I know, like you said, you're still working on your program, but how are you kind of prioritizing? You know, I'm sure, right, this is something many people, homeowners, affordable apartment owners, you know, are going to be seeking out. But generally, how do you prioritize? What are you looking for in the project, the benefits?
So two things. One, we want to do hard things with this program. So we don't only want to be working in the most solar-friendly states or the places where the policy lines up. Otherwise, what would be the use of this program if we're just going to work in places where it already works? We really want to reach Americans that haven't been able to have access to this program in the past. And some states have programs like this. So we want to serve all those folks, but we're going to really try to do hard things with the program. And we are going to be working through our affordable housing partners. So we won't be advertising to the general population, hey, come to Grid Alternatives. Some of our offices, we do that work if we have the funding to do it. But with this specific government dollar, we are going to be working through our partners. So Enterprise, NeighborWorks, LISC are basically going to be our outreach on the ground to their constituents. So folks that have gotten houses or getting rehab services from those affordable housing developers. On the single family side, the income limit will be 80% of the area median income or 200% of federal poverty level, whichever is greater. And where there will probably be some other categorical eligibility, like if someone already participates in a program like SNAP or LIHEAP, they would automatically then qualify. And then on the multifamily side, we're likely, and this is again something that we're still working out, but we're likely to work mostly with deed restricted affordable housing. That means that the apartment building is restricted in the deed to stay affordable for a certain period of time. And we'll probably be looking at some of the rules that we used when we were rolling out the SOMA program in California to look at what are, you know, how many years of the deed restriction need to be left to be able to serve that property. But again, looking at doing all of this through the footprint of buildings and housing that our partners have built and are building over the last many years.
Yeah, thank you for that, Erica. And you, and obviously that was a good overview on like how you're trying to reach other markets that you said that aren't so difficult. What about like reaching the extremely low income household population to make sure they're not excluded? Will you be working with various types of community partners to reach that population?
I want to say that is also hard. So I think yes, and some of our most vulnerable communities are struggling with housing in general. And one of the projects that actually made the news when we first were awarded the Solar for All grant and was part of the White House's announcement was a project that we've already completed in San Diego serving adults transitioning from foster care. And that was called the Trolley Trestle Project. People can look it up online. And that kind of project where you're sort of serving those most vulnerable through other nonprofit organizations is stuff that really motivates our staff and our organization every day. So again, I'll name all the partners, and some of these partners are serving what you're considering here, very low income. And I think we can be creative with community solar, with some of the multifamily community benefits to serve as best we can folks that are vulnerable specifically in housing, because there's lots of folks that are transitioning out of homelessness, out of the foster care system, fixed income seniors, other vulnerable communities. Those folks are very difficult to serve and may or may not live in affordable housing. And then I said I was going to name the partners again. I forgot. So Habitat for Humanity, NeighborWorks America, Enterprise Community Partners, Local Initiative Support Corp, or LISC, National Equity Fund, National Housing Trust, Housing Partnerships Network, World Resources Institute, and Rewiring America, all of which have many, many, many decades of experience working with low-income and very low-income individuals, specifically working on our housing crisis. And so renewable energy is a perfect match with that, because energy is a huge part of what people pay on their in their housing costs. And if we can't make energy affordable, then we are not making housing affordable.
Yeah, thank you for that, Erica. I also wanted to have a couple of questions geared around kind of some of the what you said, the difficulties, right? Well, the obstacles, because in addition to installation of the panels, like, is there assistance with any necessary permitting, interconnections, et cetera? And, you know, what types of obstacles do you foresee around perhaps roofs not being suitable for solar? Are there any certain jurisdictions that are not solar friendly? Can you speak to some of that?
Sure. Some of this, while the Solar for All program is not a market starting program, some of it is going to be early stages in emerging markets where maybe the local permit department has never permitted a solar installation before, or the utility has never interconnected a solar installation before, or maybe they have, but it's been very few. So I think some of the challenges are going to be early market policy regulatory challenges. And the other challenges are going to be site barriers, like you're talking about, a house barrier. So on the policy regulatory side, we're going to need to leverage some of the best practices, some of the policy work that many organizations have been doing at the state level and that states are doing themselves. Their energy departments, their housing departments are working on. And it's going to be tricky because, like I said, You'll have to interconnect to the utility. So, and there's many utilities across these 30 states. If we just pick one state, like your home state, there's many utilities. So we're going to need a lot of utility support and partnership. And then there's also things like the virtual net metering that I was talking about that will be a barrier in some states, but not others. Some community solar laws that will be a barrier in some states and not others. And then on the household side, a lot needs to happen to be able to get a house solar ready. First of all, it needs to have sunshine. So trees are a barrier. Now, they're not, it depends on where you live, but if your house is completely shaded and covered in trees, it's not a good candidate for solar. And then beyond that, there's things like maybe your main surface panel, you know, your breaker box needs to be upgraded, or maybe you need a new roof, or maybe you need some energy efficiency. And so layering is going to be really critical in terms of our ability to work with some of those households. We don't only want to serve the most solar ready household. We want to be able to do the main surface panel upgrade, to do some energy efficiency work, to make the house solar ready. And to be able to do that, we're going to have to partner with states, cities, and these affordable housing developers, all of which have dollars and have programs to be able to do some of that work. So in nearly every state, there is some sort of low-income weatherization program. There's usually rehab dollars to help homeowners and apartment buildings upgrade. So we're going to need to be layering and leveraging all of those dollars. So it's really going to be an effort of many. The good thing about this is think of how many jobs that entails. I read a great article, and we've been talking about this internally, how electricians are really the unsung heroes of the clean energy transition, and how those are jobs that have a lot of career mobility. You know, you don't only get to just do solar, but you can do a lot of other things. And so I think that the job opportunity and the workforce development opportunity here to, you know, get mission-aligned contractors, family, small mom-and-pop contractors in local communities, the work to do the main service panel upgrade, to do the roofing, to install the solar is going to be a huge deal. And I didn't really talk about how we are planning on doing installation work as part of these two big programs. We are planning on doing some of the installation work ourselves where we have that footprint. But then the majority of it, we are planning on building up what we're calling a mission-aligned contractor network. So local contractors in the communities that we're working in that can get that work. And that then builds wealth beyond the lower bills that the solar's providing.
Erica, that's a lot of impact. Erica, just kind of one last question to wrap it up. And you kind of touched on this a little bit. First was, you know, how do people even maybe, if the right word is apply, I'll turn over a second, but you mentioned probably through your nonprofit partners and so forth. And then really the last piece is, second part of the question is, how does this money come to a project? I know just earlier you referenced no-cost solar. But my question was going to be, is it grants? Is it low interest rate loans? You know, how is it coming to the owner or sponsor?
So in most cases, we're going to be providing rebates and incentives to be able to get to that no-cost solar or very low-cost solar. There are many other entities that are going to be providing loans, and we hope to leverage some of those loans, and we actually have one in-house ourselves, to do bridge and gap financing for, say, multifamily affordable housing projects that might need that to be able to stack along with the rebates incentives that we're going to be using.
Very good. That's it for this episode of The Buzz House, catching up with Erica Mackey of Grid Alternatives and discussing the Solar for All program in general, and then getting into more specifics into Grid's two programs. Once again, I'm Don Bernards.
And I'm Garrett Gibson. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. For additional resources around multifamily housing, check out BakerTilly.com. If you have a suggestion for the show, email us at buildabakertilly.com. That's build@bakertilly.com. See you next time on Buzz House.